This is Close Reads,
a philosophy podcast with Mark and Wes.
I'm Wes Alwyn.
And I'm Mark Lintonmeyer. We are embarking on a new unit. We took a week off, actually 2 weeks of recording off, but a week for you folks. We are on Partially Examined Life, right in the middle, two out of four episodes probably through, a unit on ethics, on the phenomenology of ethics, on phenomenology of sympathy, ethical intuitionism, sentimentalism, considering things like that. And so we started with Franz Brentano. We're going to read Max Scheler and Edith Stein. And the missing link in there is Edmund Husserl, that while Franz Brentano was the grandfather of phenomenology, Husserl was the guy who actually came up with it. I know we just did Husserl on the show pretty recently, but after reading some of the Scheler, it seemed like it would be nice to figure out what exactly in Husserl he is channeling. So I know one of the sources is Cartesian Meditations that we covered on the show, probably not in enough detail, frankly. It would be nice to return to that sometime, but I ran across this. So Ideas Part 2. So we read some of Ideas. That came out in 1913 or so, something like that. Ideas Part 2. So this is like Das Kapital, like where there's a Volume 2 and there's a Volume 3 that were not published until after his death. But it looks like from looking at the intro here of Ideas Part 2 that he wrote most of it immediately after writing Part 1. So, you know, by 1915. And then Edith Stein, one of our other authors, was his research assistant and actually did some redactions, you know, or help process his lectures from 1913, 1914 into what we're reading here. So yeah, it's the entire thing is about the Constitution. So we have a part one that is about the Constitution of material nature, part two, the Constitution of animal nature, and we're going to be reading the beginning of section three, the Constitution of the Spiritual World, chapter one, opposition between the naturalistic and personalistic worlds. So that seems like it might be more meaty, or at least, you know, what he has to say about social sciences, as opposed to what we read last time, which was just setting up his method.
Okay.
Any introductory thoughts?
I haven't looked at this, so I don't.
Yeah, no, there's no reason you should have. Well, hopefully people will not. Hopefully you will not. I was surprised that you agreed to do this, but I'm interested in reading more of him. I don't want to read the entire 400 pages of this manuscript plus, you know, whatever part three would amount to. It was hard enough doing what we did with the little tiny bit of part one, but let's at least get a taste of this. So yeah, here, section three, the Constitution of the Spiritual World. We're going to skip the little introduction, which just looks like it's a bunch of name dropping. But start on chapter one, opposition between the naturalistic and personalistic worlds. Please go.
All right, 49, the personalistic attitude versus the naturalistic. We link our considerations to what has been established in carrying out the pure phenomenological analyses of the preceding sections. In those sections, our investigations were related to the naturalistic attitude. It was in that attitude that we carried out our analyses. It is easy to understand, however, that all the investigations will assume the character of pure phenomenology simply by our performing, in the appropriate way, the phenomenological reductions. As long as we live in the naturalistic attitude, it itself is not given in our field of research. What is grasped there is only what is experienced in it, what is thought in it, etc. But if we carry out phenomenological reflection and the phenomenological reduction, make the attitude itself thematic, relate it to what is investigated in it, and lastly carry out an eidetic reduction and purification of all transcending apperceptions, then all our investigations are transformed into purely phenomenological ones.
Maybe let's stop there. So I know hopefully what we talked about last time should be enough to kind of set this up, even if we don't know what reductions plural means, the transcending apperceptions, the eidetic reduction, right? Eidetic has to do with essences. But I know that, right, the naturalistic attitude is just the attitude we have in both everyday activity and in natural science, where we treat the objects in the world as real physical things to be studied, for instance. Whereas then when we perform the reduction, we are placing the whole realism versus idealism debate in abeyance. We're just going to consider the pure appearances without regard to their ultimate metaphysical status.
Right. Carry out an eidetic reduction and purification of all transcending apperceptions. I'm not sure what that means.
I'm trying to remember what an apperception amounts to.
Well, as self-consciousness.
Oh, okay.
It's the I think, but...
So, yeah, the transcendental ego, for instance, we're not going to... I believe he is closer to Kant than he is to Sartre on the idea of the transcendental ego, right? For Kant, there is something that is required in our metaphysics, even though we can't know much about metaphysics due to the limits of pure reason. But there has to be something to unify my various experiences over time. And I think Husserl agrees with that, that there is something within experience that we experience as a unifier. But we're going to not posit that, oh, that's a real soul out there in the world or something, or that is merely a construction that we put together. We're not going to decide either of those things. We're just going to say, yes, this is one of the structures of appearance, which is not that different than what Kant actually said.
So we're going to bracket out the question of whether there are things in themselves,
yep,
on the other side of the phenomena. And then we're going to bracket out the question of whether there's a ego thing in itself on the near side of phenomena, and we're going to be stuck in the middle with the phenomena. All right. As subject of the naturalistic attitude, we have then the pure ego. To be sure, we will at first find ourselves in reflection as empirical ego. We perform the reflection at first precisely as a new naturalistic attitude, which thus, in the phenomenological reduction, belongs in brackets. The ultimate subject, the phenomenological one, which can never be bracketed and is the very subject doing all the eidetic phenomenological research, is the pure ego. Oh, well, maybe we can't bracket. All right. For the rest, all that has been put in out of play remains for us, here as elsewhere, preserved in the bracketing modification, that is, the whole world of the naturalistic attitude, nature, in the broadest sense of the term.
Yeah, I didn't, I guess we should have, the fact that he was talking about reductions, that there is more than just a single bracketing. So I can't pretend, without having read all the intervening pages, to understand how we are doing this repeatedly, but you can think of just him talking about the process of purification that you can, in chemistry or whatever, you don't just do something once. You could just run it through the process, or run it through various processes, various filters, and purify. So something like that is going on. Maybe it's just you try to bracket out, but you find that you actually can't. Right? That you're, at least this is what Descartes would be afraid of, that we fall into, right? This is why he says, I'm going to just assume that all these beliefs that I had about the natural world are actively false, not just put them in abeyance, not saying I don't know, but I'm going to more strongly. So maybe, obviously, Husserl doesn't want to do that exactly, doesn't, play around with something like a I could be deceived by an evil deceiver, but there is something that he is doing with these repeated bracketings that is supposed to further more successfully bracket. But it sounds like, if you could successfully do it the first time, I don't know why you would need additional steps.
Well, let's go back to this distinction between the empirical ego and the pure ego, which parallels a distinction Kant makes between the empirical ego and the transcendental ego. The empirical ego is just ourselves as we find ourselves in the phenomena. So, for instance, my pain, my distress, my desire, maybe even my body, anything that we can experience empirically about ourselves, including our own psychological states, belongs with the empirical ego. The transcendental ego, which I assume is the same as the pure ego that he's talking about here, is just a bare representation of the I, and it's not the empirical self. It's not I as referring to my body, but I in the most abstract sense, I as in the subject, the continuous subject of my stream of consciousness. And then the question is, what accounts for the personal identity? What counts for the continuity of the stream of consciousness and the fact that it belongs to the same I over time? And we've done an episode on that, and one might want to think, well, there's a substantial metaphysical ego to which everything belongs. I think that's a position, right, embraced by Descartes, but that Locke rejected, and Locke has his own interesting account of how we get at that continuity. I think for Kant, right, it's not that we always have to represent an I think, and we don't always say I think with every experience. Sometimes it's just the way Kant puts it, you know, we have to be capable. Experience has to be such that it's, we could always say I think, right, if we were to attend
right
to it. But there's always, at least at some kind of implicit level, maybe it's even, we might call it implicit or procedural, there's kind of a, you know, there's some sort of unity that, and continuity across time that makes experience susceptible to, to this representation of an I behind it. So, okay. So, and then the idea is that we can't bracket out, well, we can't bracket out the phenomenological, right? That doesn't make any sense. What we're bracketing out are things in themselves. It wouldn't, right? It doesn't make sense to bracket out the phenomenological in the same way. It doesn't make sense to say, am I really in pain right now? We just have access to our own pain, right? Or am I really experiencing this as red? It makes sense to say, is it really red? It doesn't make sense to say, am I really experiencing it as red? Yes. You know, if you experience it as red, that's something that can't be bracketed. But the ultimate subject is the pure ego. So it sounds like we can't bracket out the pure ego.
Right. So the question is how does the pure ego differ from, so the empirical ego, right, seems like it's attached to a body, has our personality, has our history, that kind of thing.
So we don't bracket that out because it's, you know, that's just part of the phenomena. But the pure ego is the I think, right? I think if we say, well, it's not the metaphysical ego, right? We bracket out the metaphysical ego, the substance. But if by pure ego he means transcendental ego, then I think we can see why that's not bracketable.
Let me just look a little closely at the wording here. As long as we live in the naturalistic attitude, it itself is not given in our field of research. So, right, we're living life, we're studying things, we're not studying the act of studying. What is grasped there is only what is experienced in it, what is thought in it, etc. If we carry out phenomenological reflection and the phenomenological reduction, make the attitude itself thematic, relate to it what is investigated in it. Okay, so this is the steps. I want to see if we can figure these out. We carry out the phenomenological reduction. Make the attitude itself thematic, so we're considering the act of considering. Relate to it what is investigated in it. That I'm not really sure. There's too many it's there. So what is investigated in the phenomenological attitude, we want to relate to the phenomenological attitude. It sounds like we're getting at something about the I, right? The I, we're saying the I is the subject of the naturalistic attitude is going to be the pure ego. I'm just not sure how the idea of a subject fits in with phenomenology, in that it's not, as you say, the empirical ego, which is not the subject, It just has to be some, and we don't want to, as you were saying, posit a transcendental ego as a, well, as a metaphysical. But
we don't want to posit a metaphysical
ego. Yes, exactly, ego. A soul.
The transcendental ego is a different
is a structure.
Animal.
So a structure, an eidetic structure. That is what the pure ego is. And lastly, carry out an eidetic reduction and purification of all transcending apperceptions. So what is it? Okay, I guess that's what the transcending apperceptions, it's the plural that's confusing me. All transcending apperceptions. I guess that's just that.
I think.
Yeah, okay. So that at any point you could reflect and include the subject in your observation of consciousness. So those are various apperceptions.
Right. So apperception, right? When I experience something, I also experience, and this is very important to phenomenology, but I also attribute it to myself.
Yep.
Right. And even if I'm not saying I think, so there's, I've read recent phenomenologists who say even animals do this, right? It's still, the experience is still referenced to this unity of consciousness across time. It's implicitly referenced to that. So that's the apperception.
To be sure, we will at first find ourselves in reflection as empirical ego. Okay. So yeah, of course, right. When we reflect within the naturalistic attitude, we do think that it's the empirical ego that is doing it. The thing that has the personality, the thing that has the history. I am the one thinking. We perform the reflection at first precisely as a new naturalistic attitude, which we then want to bracket. So that's what's confusing me.
Well, maybe the new naturalistic attitude, you know, if we're doing reflection about, you know, if we're reflecting on the ego, then initially we take the empirical ego to be the ego.
Yep.
We have a naturalistic attitude towards the ego. So the ego just is the psychological ego, right? My psychological states, my body, anything that I can find in experience. And that's the kind of the attitude taken towards the ego by most contemporary psychologists, I think. Naturally, we would want to bracket that out. Well, we can't bracket.
Yeah. No, we do. We, in the phenomenological reduction, it belongs in brackets. I'm not sure why this constitutes, it just seems it's the same naturalistic attitude. Like the naturalistic attitude includes not only perception and thinking about stuff outside, but it also includes the capability of reflection and the whole apparatus of the empirical ego. But he's saying, to be sure, we will find it first find ourselves in reflection as empirical ego. We perform the reflection at first precisely as a new naturalistic attitude. Yeah, I just don't know why it's new, but I don't know that we're going to figure that out.
Well, there's the naturalistic attitude we have towards external objects.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a naturalistic attitude towards the ego.
Sure.
I mean, I think the bracketing has to do with treating that empirical ego as if it were, right, something of as a substance. Because again, obviously, our psychological states and things like pain and so on are not bracketable. But you know, this attribution to a, So anyway, I think there's crossover here between the empirical ego and the metaphysical ego. But
the ultimate subject, the phenomenological one, which can never be bracketed and is the very subject doing all eidetic phenomenological research, is the pure ego. Everything else has been put out of play. So I guess I don't really see, there's only, from looking more carefully, it looks like there is only a single reduction. I would call it a single naturalistic attitude that, you know, encompasses multiple things and includes reflection. But yeah, if he wants to say there are multiple reflections, but there's not we still don't know why then he said reductions plural in the previous paragraph. There's nothing here that would show that up. Okay. Moving to the second page. As we know, it pertains to the essence of this nature, which consequently emerges here as the pure sense of the acts that make up the natural attitude, as their constitutive correlate, that a thorough grounding is accomplished as the positing of nature in the first sense, that of physical nature, in which everything else that is called nature has the source of its sense, as something founded therein.
All right, separate there.
Yeah, that's pretty hard.
The essence of this nature, which nature? The essence of this nature.
Oh, the pure ego.
Natural nature in the previous sentences. The whole world of the naturalistic attitude, nature in the broadest sense of the term. Okay, so
yep.
Objects, empirical objects, pertains to the essence of this nature. Emerges here is the pure sense of the acts that make up the natural attitude. So again, I would just call them empirical objects.
And pure sense is italicized. Not sure if that's supposed to be a technical term or have anything to do with the Phrygian sense or something, but it's, what is?
Well, I mean, if anything, it would probably maybe be Kant's sense as opposed to understanding, but.
Or just for them to make sense, right? If we want to say, what is the meaning of the acts that make up the natural attitude? It is being in nature. I guess I'm sort of giving a Heideggerian.
Yeah. The constitutive correlate of the natural attitude is just the objects of experience, or that's, I think that would be a much simpler way of putting it. Grounding. Okay, thorough grounding is accomplished as the positing of nature in the first sense, that of a physical nature, in which everything else that is called nature has the source of its sense as something found therein.
So psychological and sociological.
Yeah, so in other words, we're materialists in the naturalistic framework. Mm-hmm. We prioritize the physicality of nature and make everything derivative of that.
Okay. Thus we're built on one another with respect to the constituting basic characters of the apprehension. The experience of the physical as foundational and resting on it and enveloping it, the experience of the body, which is constitutive of man and animal. Based on the latter as constitutive stratum is the experience of the soul. The total system of naturalistic experiences encompasses the whole of nature as the total domain of the natural sciences in the stricter and in the broadest sense. Belonging here, therefore, is psychology too, as the natural science of the psychic being of animalia, humans and animals, which thus fits within anthropology and so within general zoology as natural sciences. Psychic being includes the psychic ego subject, the ego subject as nature. We recall, however, that there are difficulties and objections related to this ego, namely ones regarding a distinction which obtrudes, but which does not yet impose itself as it should, i.e. a distinction between this ego and the ego as person or as member of a social world. It is this distinction we want to investigate, and specifically by research in constitutive phenomenology.
All right, so the first part of this I don't think is very difficult. We gave a gloss on this in our previous comments, but yeah, the physical is foundational and we build on top of that. And then there's the body, there's the experience of the body, and then there's the experience of the psyche as derivative of that. So we get the domain of natural sciences that includes psychology. And then it's at the end here we get to something interesting. Psychic being includes the psychic ego subject, the ego subject as nature. So again, I think this is just the empirical ego. Mm-hmm. And this is, right, again, these are all distinctions that Kant made. He's not doing anything new here. Kant made a big deal of, right, what we're doing as transcendental philosophers versus what we're doing as psychologists. We need to be clear on that. So anyway, we recall, however, that there are difficulties and objections related to this ego, the distinction which obtrudes between the ego as person or member of a social world. So this is something new.
This ego and the ego as person, yes. So this ego, the ego subject as nature. Right, so it seems like you got what Descartes identifies in his reduction, let's call it that, as his ego versus... In the natural attitude, we should see, and again, I'm sort of taking cues here from Heidegger, who probably stole all this stuff, is, hey, Descartes, to even be sitting there doing your little experiment, you have to have been someone, for instance, who has language, who learned this language in a society. So there are things that are constitutive of the naturalistic attitude, or at least reflection within the naturalistic attitude, including, so it's not just, even though it seems like it's just ego as, you know, something, my mind that's associated with the body and it has a history. Well, part of that is being a member of a social world. So, but that never comes up in Descartes, right? He just, you know, that's not what he sees when he reduces or even considers himself with a naturalistic attitude.
I'm a bit confused here because for Kant, there was this very clear distinction between the empirical ego, the transcendental ego, and the metaphysical ego. The empirical ego for Kant was purely a matter of part of the phenomena. But, right, as we know, Kant was working against a point of view in which the empirical and the metaphysical coincide, right? That's the naturalistic attitude. The empirical objects, the empirical phenomena just are things in themselves. And so when Husserl says ego subject as nature, it sounds like for him, this empirical ego and the metaphysical ego coincide as objects of the natural attitude. In any case, right, ego subject as nature, which I'm identifying with the empirical ego, there's a distinction between that and ego as person, and then ego as member of a social world. So I think we have ego as a person, a member of a social world, I suppose, maybe he's going to identify them. So we either have two or three buckets here. One is empirical ego, the other is ego as person, the other is ego as member of a social world. I would think those things would be separate, right? Because I think of person as subject or as personal identity or something like that. And so we can understand why, you know, this ego subject as nature would be distinguished from ego as person, right? So the sort of naturalistic attitude towards an ego versus the pure subject. But this is an interesting wrinkle with member of a social world. And in a way, it's the Hegelian wrinkle.
So you're saying for Kant, the metaphysical ego is pure subject? Or for Kant, it's the thing that is a noumenon that we can't actually, like the transcendental ego might point at it, but the transcendental ego is just really a structure of experience, which is what Heidegger, what Husserl's playing.
So for Kant, there's a distinction between transcendental ego, empirical ego, and ego as thing in itself, as Cartesian substance ego. Those three things are separate, although they tend to be all get identified with each other. And he wants to tease out these distinctions and say identifying them leads to all sorts of metaphysical errors. That's the whole point of the Critique of Pure Reason, is to get these things separate so we stop making these big metaphysical errors and say we can't really do metaphysics about the ego. It's not a noble thing. We can do the empirical sciences. It's not that we can't do metaphysics. We can't really know anything about metaphysical objects. We can't know anything about the ego as a metaphysical object. But my point here is that, the naturalistic attitude tends to make this conflation. And so when Husserl talks about ego subject as nature, which sounds a lot like the empirical ego, he's perhaps also talking about the metaphysical ego, just because those things from the naturalistic standpoint are completely conflated. And I'm doing that because for Kant, the empirical ego is purely phenomenal, right? That's after he's teased out the distinction. He's not making that conflation, but the naturalistic attitude does. And so when Husserl wants to, so that's what I'm trying to, and maybe I'll turn out to be wrong, but I think when he says ego subject is nature, he's thinking of this, of the ego from the standpoint of the naturalistic attitude, and then we're going to distinguish that from ego as person or ego as member of a social world.
Right. I don't know if Husserl's conception of the natural attitude's take on the ego is as pretentious as, you know, everybody just assumes in the natural attitude that the the locus of your experience, and the thing with personality and the thing with the body is also the metaphysical soul and foundation. Whereas I think he's saying, no, it's actually, we just take the animal, the material as, so we don't actually have a soul ontology in the natural attitude at all. At least there's no assumption.
We don't need
something beyond that.
We don't need a metaphysical soul, right? We can be complete materialists, but there's still metaphysics there, right? So, and that tends to be the metaphysics of many contemporary,
psychologists
or neuroscientists, right?
The first section of section two is called the pure ego. So clearly we're just trying to figure out something that we didn't read. I think we're close enough. I can't remember if I got to the end of the paragraph.
Yeah, you did.
Okay, so you want to start
So I'll go on the next
one.
Yes. Introjection of the soul as presupposition even for the naturalistic attitude.
Oh, okay. So maybe I'm very wrong.
Introjection of the soul. Okay. Let us begin with the soul. Good. That's a good beginning. For natural science, it is nothing per se. It is merely a stratum of real occurrences in the body. Okay, right? So materialistic position. Mm-hmm. In material nature, obviously this is the objectively true nature, with respect to which appearing nature, the thing world with secondary qualities, appearing to me and to everyone else, is precisely mere appearance. Their color, as we all agree, within the naturalistic attitude, there occur, as we all agree, within the naturalistic attitude, certain preeminent things, ones distinguished by means of a stratum of real qualities that are not specifically physical, not material, or extensive. I refer, of course, to the properties of stimulatability or sensitivity. All right, let's stop there. So natural science, right? We treat the soul as something material. Fine.
And he's saying over and above primary qualities that we acknowledge in science, in the natural attitude, sensitivity. Stimulatability. That, I guess, let's keep going, because I think this just means like the disposition of natural, right? That something by its texture can give us color impressions, and that's part of he wants to say it's not just primary qualities versus secondary qualities in the mind. It's primary qualities, and among those are the ones that we are sensitive to, or their sensitivity to us. We don't know yet, really.
Well, he's saying, right. So we have qualia. But there are also these preeminent things that are not physical, not material, not specifically physical.
And then he puts the following immaterial and extensive in quotes. So like, what is he?
Right. So not extension, right? Which is Descartes' conception of matter, not spatiotemporal, in other words. So it sounds suspiciously on the verge of positing something metaphysical.
It sounds like maybe it's just relational, right? The fact that, saying, yes, okay, something that is has a texture such that it's going to give me a certain color impression. Well, yes, your Locke or your Descartes is just going to say what's really in the object is just the texture, including its fine things, and then we approach it and we get this. But phenomenologically, he's going to want to say even, a phenomenological take on the natural attitude, which is what this whole thing is about, is going to say, no, there needs to be a receptivity of the thing to us or something like that, such that we don't want to call the fine texture that gives us the color impression, we don't want to call that precisely physical in the way that Locke did. That's my guess.
Okay. I'm not so sure. I just think, you know, here he's saying, right, stimulability and sensitivity, right? So there's a subject, there's a receptive subject that is itself not physical, right? So in other words, we don't have to be say that there are such things as metaphysical souls in order to say, well, the subject doesn't seem like it's material, right? Our ideas, our experiences, our qualia, those things themselves aren't material. And our faculties, we can't call them, you know, the sensitivity, for instance, material. But yeah, let's go on.
These new properties are constituted in the form of localization and are, in conformity with their sense, dependent on physical corporeality and through that dependent on physical nature in general. The higher stratum, specifically psychic, is likewise experienced in a way which is, to this extent, similar to the experience of the aesthesiological, that is, precisely as a stratum of the body as thing, insofar as this stratum, too, is in a certain manner localized. The soul animates or besouls the body, and the animated body is a natural object within the unity of the spatiotemporal world.
So these new properties, like stimulatability, are constituted in the form of localization, which it sounds like Aristotelian immanent form in a way, right? If we were thinking of our sensory faculties as mysteriously formal, they're still localized in a particular physical animal.
Yep. And they have dependence relations. We don't know that he could use supervenience or something like that. We don't really understand how the psychological is related to the physical, but we do perceive it. We do experience it in the natural attitude as, of course, you know, it's not Cartesian dualism. It is, in some way, the mental is based on the physical, and the qualia of the color is somehow based on the thing that I'm looking at.
Yeah. For every mental state, right, there's a brain state. So we know it's, right, there aren't mental states floating around without some physical basis. The higher stratum, the psychic, is experienced. Okay. The higher stratum, the specifically psychic, is likewise experienced in a way which is, to this extent, similar to the experience of the aesthesiological. Precisely as a stratum of the body as thing. What is this term aesthesiological?
Let's see. What is it? So it says you must mean the internet thinks I must mean anesthesiology. No, it's aesthesiology, like study of the special senses, the ears, the eye. So yeah, it's almost like aesthetics, which is literally not about beauty, but it is about appearance. Right. So it's just referring to
the animated body is a natural object within the unity of the spatiotemporal world. You know, in a way, it's if we want to talk about these different what I think this amounts to is the biological, including the sensory, is something emergent. And not simply reducible. We know it's based on the physical, but ensouled beings in a sense. And I think, contemporary philosophers would admit this, right? Not all biological talk is reducible to talk about atoms, for instance. We would lose something if we tried to make that reduction. So even though we know it's all based on particles at the deepest level, it doesn't mean that we could just translate all our macro phenomenal talk, including biological talk, into, here's the location of all the particles in the world at time t, and then at t1, and then time t2, and so on. So we kind of get this experience when we encounter a living thing, and its eyes, for instance, its sensory organs. Right, we encounter it not as just another thing, we encounter its stimulatability. We encounter, in some sense, this reminds me of, with Scheller saying that the mental states of others are in a way part of their phenomenal, their intentional objects.
Yep. Right. So the higher, the psychic stratum is experienced as a stratum of the body as thing, localized.
So this is part of the paradox, right? Because the psyche isn't a thing, but it certainly is a, and so it's not localizable within the spatiotemporal field, but the body that it's dependent on is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you go on?
I see a playing cat. Oh, so we...
We're going to have an example. Woo.
We didn't have to make up our own example. I see a playing cat, and I regard it now as something of nature, just as is done in zoology. I see it as a physical organism, but also as a sensing and animated body. Okay, we were on the right track. I see it precisely as a cat. I see it in the general sense ordinarily meant when speaking of seeing. A stone is seen in any at all of its perceptual appearances, in which, strictly, only very little of it is presented in actual proper perception, right? We only get an angle.
Sure.
If, on account of the one-sidedness and other multifarious imperfections, we were not to allow the seeing to count as a seeing, as a perceiving, then talk about seeing would lose its essential sense forthwith. There is indeed no seeing of a physical thing that would not be imperfect in this manner. Right? So he's saying, even though it's imperfect, we don't want to say that we don't see the object.
Yep.
Perception of something physical, in conformity with its essence, includes indeterminations, but includes them as determinable.
In other words,
we could walk around to the other side of the stone and see all the, or turn it over in our hand. In its own way, the cat also is seen, and in the seeing, its existence as this animal, cat, is experienced. The experience has the kind of imperfections corresponding to the fundamental character of experience of animals. But as always, the cat is present there in the flesh, specifically as a physical thing with sensing surfaces, sense organs. The stratum of sensation is not there as something beside the physical thing. What is there is a body which has physical and aesthesiological qualities as one. Likewise, the body is also experienced as body of a soul, and the word soul indicates, again, a founded stratum of qualities, and of course, one that is still higher. The soul is not there as extended over the body in the manner of being localized in the proper sense. It does not offer itself as something like a complex of psychic fields, thought in an analogy with sense fields, which would come immediately to phenomenal coincidence with the extensional components of the body. All right, maybe we should, or which would come to a determinate correspondence with them, either point for point or part for part. All right, I'm. That's as much as I can.
Yeah.
Bite off.
It all seems pretty clear to me. Just that. So he was using this word aesthesiological. He could have just said sensory, but I think he wanted to point to it's more sensing. He wants to point to the, so I perceive the cat not only as an object, but as an object that is sensing things around it. I'm aware of that about it.
Yeah.
And right, so how do we see, again, I think this word supervenient would have been nice as the vague term that philosophers use to say whatever the, I guess he's talking, maybe the problem with that is, does supervenient assume a sort of part-to-part correspondence? In other words, this part of the mind corresponds to the cat's foot, and this corresponds to, or exactly this part of the brain. Certainly, even if that is true, I don't know that we perceive it as such. Like, we perceive the mentality is more a general vibe, an aura about it. It is, an activity of the creature. It is the type of creature that has mentality.
The word soul indicates a founded stratum of qualities, not extended over the body. Yeah, it's a little unclear.
Maybe my idea of auras doesn't make, because it does not offer itself. It's something like a complex of psychic fields, thought an analogy with sense fields, which is maybe that's auras.
Where there's a coincidence with the extensional components of the body, which is, you know, part to part, as you were talking about, right? This part of the soul corresponds to this part of the body.
Even though it, like, I can identify the cat's eyes, I still don't think that the mind, like, is the eyes or lives in the eyes or something like that. Or that, yeah.
All right, let's read on. Maybe it'll get...
In spite of that, the psychic is, in experience, one. That is, realiter one, with the body. To that extent, it is something at the body or in it, lacking only distinguishable separate location. One could employ the expression, misleading to be sure, of introjection. It would then express precisely the state of affairs. In the objective world, in the objective world space, there appears here and now this objectively real cat. It is something physical and moves physically just like other things, except that beyond the merely physical qualities, it constantly has the aesthesiological and psychic ones. The excess of reality beyond the mere physical thing is not something that can be separated off by itself, not something juxtaposed, but something in the physical thing. Thus it moves along with the thing and acquires its spatial determination by its being in something which is itself spatial.
So yeah, so more about this paradox of a non-spatiotemporal reality somehow being localized in a spatiotemporal body. The psychic is one with the body.
All right, we got one more paragraph, and then we actually will have a section called Localization of the Psychic. Which I thought that's what we were already talking about, but go ahead.
As we can direct our analyzing regard onto other properties, so we can also turn to these psychic ones. They then stand out as a stratum, as a really inseparable annex of the physical body as a thing, which for its part would be thinkable without such strata, though, of course, only with the corresponding transformation, which is termed decomposition of the organism, organic death. So, in other words, we can think of the body without the soul, but then it would be dead. All these are not arbitrary inventions, but are pure unfoldings of what lies in the very sense of the naturalistic apprehension, animal real, an apprehension which is determinant a priori for the sense of all zoological judgments and cognitions, insofar as they indeed originally draw the meaning content of their concepts from such an apprehension. That which is included a priori in the sense of zoological experience and the sense content of this essential type of experience makes possible zoological science in precisely that sense, just as the content with its eidetic laws enclosed in the essential type physical experience makes possible the science of physical nature. If we think the one or the other type of experience of, sorry, think, okay, if we think the one or the other type of experience as canceled out, then the concomitant experiential concepts, judgments, and sciences vanish eo ipso. So I think one thing to note here is that, right, what he's calling zoological experience, our capacity to experience other organisms as animated, right, is it's a real capacity or an accomplishment. I think it has to be right. It has to be hardwired evolutionarily, but there's no right. Otherwise, right. We don't just have access to every emergent domain. Whether it's the biological or the psychical or something else, that has to be grounded in something. So I think that's what he's right. There's something a priori about zoological experience, about the capacity to grasp things as animate.
Right. So I think ultimately, right, with our Shaler is arguing that we perceive the existence of other people, not because I only perceive myself or I perceive your body and then I infer that you must have a soul like mine or must have a mind like mine, but I can somehow just perceive it directly. And so this is a way of setting that up, is how can we perceive it directly? Well, we perceive it as a stratum of the physical. So yes, we do just see the body. I don't literally see little soul fibers or your mind sparking or whatever it would be to see from your point of view, the inside of your mind. But I do still see that, you know, to see something zoologically is to see it as animated, as having a sensing capacity, at least. We haven't gotten to thinking.
Well, also purposiveness. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, why mirror neurons made a splash, mm-hmm. which is that part of it is the way we see other animate creatures as essentially purposive, as having ends, as having goals. And right, so if we see a monkey trying to open a jar, for instance, our mirror neurons actually, there's a portion of our brain that the one that would be activated if we were actually ourselves opening our jar is required in order to understand, in order to perceive the monkey opening the jar, right? So in other words, we're not just perceiving it as a physical thing. Something else is activated beyond what would be activated with just some physical object, like a waterfall, right? Or the jar accidentally falling to the ground and losing its cap that way. An entirely different part of the brain that has a very special function is activated, and it's one that puts ourselves imaginatively. This is a little, goes a little bit. It sounds like it goes against Shaler, but I don't think it actually does. But anyway, it, you know, that puts ourselves in the position of the other doing the act in order to understand its purposiveness is activated. And likewise, we can think of this with the sensory as well, right? We have to be able to understand animals as having psyches in order to really grasp them as such.
Well, based on what's been said here, it seems like our way of seeing that others are animated, are minded, is actually the same way that we see our own minds. We do not see, per Descartes, first the mental and then ask what could its connection with the physical be. When you perceive yourself, you do the empirical ego, perceive yourself to be, oh, I'm me, I'm this person, I'm this body with this personality. So I perceive my own mentality as a stratum of my physicality. It's not actually any different. Is that, I don't know if he said that exactly. He just sort of moved to talking about perceiving a cat as opposed to talking about perceiving my own ego. Well, let's see if we can get this last. So it's a one page section B here. Localization of the psychic. Still, the following is striking here. Every stratum is a constituted unity. We can consider, in conformity with its essence, the matter of the constitution as abstract from the forming, realizing apprehension. I'm just puzzling over that first. A constituted unity. Okay, all right, sure, that somehow we, when we perceive these strata, presumably he said or things early about this in the book or in Ideas 1. Probably this is old hat for somebody who's been reading along. Okay,
so. Well, the body is a stratum, the psyche is a stratum, right? We know that.
Yep.
In other words, every, and I would just say these are different levels of emergence, but, you know.
Well, and you were talking about it as a localized form, so that this, by saying we can distinguish the matter of the constitution from the forming, realizing apprehension. I mean, this actually does seem like Aristotelian metaphysics is right there in our phenomenology of everyday things, of strata. We can direct our regard onto the sensation material and leave aside what is contributed by the apprehension as the body's sensing. Similarly, we can direct the regard to the unity of the stream of lived experience and leave aside the apprehension in which the stream exists as the lived state of an animal thing that has lived experiences. We can then also find, in the manifold currently presenting itself, unities that are henceforth no longer unities of nature. In particular, it is to be seen that with such a change of attitude, with such a separation from the physical body of what previously had been apprehended as psychic, all integration into the objective world, into the world space and world time, gets lost. The soul is the body, and there is where the body presently happens to be.
The soul is in the body.
The soul is in the body, and there is where the body presently happens to be. What also is there are such and such groups of states of consciousness, such and such representations, stirring of thoughts, judgments, etc. As states and states of, for instance, this cat, which has, by means of its body, its position in objective space, everything that is really one with the cat has position, even though may it have, per se, nothing to do with extension. Just as consciousness loses the apperceptive apprehension as psychic state, as stratum in the body, and just as it is purely posited as itself in the phenomenological, even if not at the same time an eidetic reduction, so it loses its empirical insertion in objective space, which can also be expressed in this way. Consciousness in itself, for example, this individual cogitato in its nexus, is thinkable without a nature, and the apperception of nature itself can be posited in itself as that there. However, it is thinkable that it, or more precisely, that the positing of nature implicit in it, may not be able to be demonstrated at all, that there is no nature at all. Then in this case, there is also no objective space, and consciousness is not positable as something of nature, as state of an animal. It is absolutely non-spatial. This seems like a lot of words to say very, very little. Are you reading it that way? You know, it's kind of what we've said. Like, yeah, the mind sort of is there, but yet we don't say, oh, there it is, exactly there. But it's certainly the cat's mind is where the cat is.
Well, again, it's just, yeah, it does seem to just be pointing to this paradox that the psyche is not spatiotemporal, but it's attached to something spatiotemporal and localizable within the spatiotemporal field. We can direct the regard to the unity of the stream of lived experience, leave aside the apprehension in which the stream exists as the lived state of an animal thing that has lived experiences. In other words, we can treat ourselves as kind of abstract cogitos. We can pay attention just to our stream of consciousness without thinking of it as localized in a body, and find in it unities that, right? And then we can think about those unities as if they were not unities of nature, right? Because we've kind of abstracted from the natural in that sense, to the extent that we introspect, let's put it that way. The separation from the physical body of what previously had been apprehended as psychic, all integration to the objective world, right, gets lost, right? So again, I just think this is about introspection and, and abstracting from the connection to the body. But then on the other hand, the soul is in the body. Yeah.
So let me project forward a future in which we don't do a part two of this. We are just done with this because I feel like I've gotten what I wanted to get out as far as Shaler goes, which is that point that our introspection and our heterospection, our grasping of other people's minds are quite similar. And we could say a lot. I see, just looking forward, looking at the section. So temporalization of the psychic, we're going to see how this exists not just in space, but in time. And then he goes to reflections on method and asks about the naturalistic attitude and the natural attitude forward to that. And that's several pages. So that's probably as far as we would get. Then finally, the person as center of a surrounding world. So this sure seems like, you know, Heidegger's being in the world kind of thing. That is also many pages. The person in personal association. So this is where we finally wanted to get, but we're not going to get there if we just read this straight. So, and that goes on even more pages, quite a few pages. Oh, and then we get to addendum, subjective manifolds of appearance and objective things. Yeah. And it just goes on for many, many more pages. So I don't know. How are you feeling about, I'm, Are you feeling like one more dip in this pond would be useful to you, or we can just say, okay, we checked it out. We were curious.
Either way, I can go with whatever you want to do on this one. I can go either way.
All right. Well, if we don't have subsequent thoughts, then I'm going to say, let's get another topic so we can have another public episode after not having one for a little bit. Thanks for being here. Now, I very well might put this on the PEL public feed just because it is actually relevant to what we're talking about in that series. If we do that, I just want to let you know. So, right, there are a couple, the way this podcast is structured, there is a Close Reads only feed. So closereadsphilosophy.com, you can go subscribe to that and hear all the public Close Reads episodes. You can also just go to patreon.com/closereadsphilosophy. And even if you just sign up as a non-paying member, you'll still get all those same public episodes, but without any ads. And that's actually the feed that goes through to Spotify. So if you listen to Close Reads on Spotify, I think, again, you still have to go to the Patreon and sign up to be a follower, a non-paying supporter. But if you do pay, it's the $5 a month, or there's a combo thing. If you're already a Patreon supporter of Partially Examined Life, then you can just up your contribution to $10. Then you'll get, you know, the part twos, the part threes, the part fours, however many we do on these various things. So that will give you a weekly experience, more or less. Whereas, you know, it's more like every 2, 3, 4 weeks if you're just on the public feeds. Okay, so that's complicated. If you liked this, we hope you do go to Close Reads, go to the Apple Podcast page for this podcast for Close Reads and give us a 5-star review. Recommend it to people. We publish anything that is a public facing, open to everybody. Part one episode of this is also available on video. So if that helps you to see our faces as we puzzle over these things, maybe that's more fun for you. Maybe not. I don't know. Thanks, Wes. See you, everybody.
Thank you.